Hi there, it's Chuck from Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation. Josh Batty is with the Bowery Presents in Boston, a concert promotion and venue management organization that runs multiple venues in Boston, including the Royale, Great Scott, and the venue where we sat for our conversation, the Sinclair. As talent booker for the Sinclair, he is not only passionate about good music, but also a good listening experience. The Sinclair, a former brewery, is an award-winning music venue and restaurant in Harvard Square, featuring the best emerging and established touring bands and an adjacent new American kitchen with gastropub influences. The kitchen features a cozy, vibrant downstairs bar and an upstairs dining room with an open kitchen and patio overlooking Church Street. Josh and his team took great care to create a fantastic room. With a state-of-the-art sound system and clear sight lines, the Sinclair has quickly become a favorite of artists and fans alike. For Ronnie and I, it is one of our favorite venues to see music, and we highly recommend checking out not only the venue, but the kitchen as well. For more information, go to sinclaircambridge.com. So here's our conversation with Josh Batty, recorded at the Sinclair in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This is number 40, Josh, by the way.
Yeah, you're number 40. It's a big, yeah, a 401. That's a big one.
Someone say you could talk, Joe? The photographer talks. He's talking a lot more lately on this podcast.
Where'd Michelle go? Oh, there she is.
Ike, one of our board of advisors, noticed that Joe was talking at the Ashley Jordan episode.
I added most of that out, actually.
Yeah. I wonder if Ashley Jordan has played here. Do you know that name? Out of Harvard, Mass. She's in her country breakout right now.
Yep.
She did play here?
She's really good.
She hasn't played here yet, though.
I think she'd be good here, yeah. Well, what do I know? You don't have to wear these. It's up to you.
I'll go for it.
They feel good.
Do they? You haven't worn them the last, like, three podcasts.
I like them now. I don't know. I think I like to hear your voice, Chuck.
Well, you know, it's my sexy podcast voice. That's what it is.
Keith didn't wear them,
no. But he's special. Not that you're not special, Josh.
He's extra special.
There you go. How often do you come in? You come in every day? I mean, you guys have a pretty busy schedule here, but...
Depends on the time of year. Probably 2 to 3 times a week I'm out at a show, whether it's here, Great Scott, Royale, or any of the other rooms.
We played at Great Scott.
That's right.
Look at that.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, Great Scott. What a classic venue.
We opened for...
Harrison Ford's son.
Harrison Ford's son
is in
came
a band.
And
it was a hard rock band.
Yeah, hard.
And we're like, more of a soft...
No, we're not soft rock.
Oh, no, no, it was David's songs. It's very pop.
Right, we were doing David's songs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway.
But we opened for him. He's a pretty good band. Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah.
He's all tatted up and everything.
There were people coming up to see that.
It was a weird night because it was, wasn't it a holiday? I think it was a holiday.
Yeah, it's right. A big BU hangout, right?
It used Obviously. To be. So the story of how that started was Carl Lavin, who works with us now, he started doing a once-a-week night there. It was kind of like an indie rock dance night. I think that was on Thursday nights, and then all of a sudden he's like, can I start putting some shows in here on a Tuesday or Wednesday? And the owner was like, yeah, go ahead, go for it. And then, you know, he was like, all right, can I throw a show in here on a Monday? Can I throw a show in here on a Friday? And then all of a sudden, you know, it became a 7-night-a-week, you know, hang, and rather than jam 300 BU kids in there when you're busy on a Friday and Saturday
right. And
dead all the other nights of the week, why not just make it a rock club? And that's kind of
interesting.
That's right. I don't remember it being a rock.
No, it was
like a stage and
right around 2004, because it's when I moved back up here to college and it started to happen. And all of a sudden you'd see these bands coming up, you know, Harrison Ford's kids. Play there.
They were good though. They were definitely good. He's got a good voice, and they were hard. It's like a real hard rock. It's
actually
like,
Harrison Ford's kid would be a good name for a band.
Harrison Ford's kid?
No, maybe not.
We're always trying to find the best
son of Han Solo.
The best.
I think there is a new act out the electronic or something. It's like Han Solo or something.
Han
like
Solo,
really?
Yeah.
I'd go listen to them just because of the name.
Just why not?
He's my freaking hero, man.
Right.
Han Solo. Kidding me?
They got a new movie coming out next year.
I still have to see the first one that came out a couple years ago.
The Force Awakens.
I don't know what it's called.
Yeah.
But I had to see
it. Force Awakens.
I gotta wait. I don't want to watch it on my little TV. I gotta want to go to my brother-in-law's house and he has a big, like, huge thing. I don't want to watch it on a little TV. I want to watch it on the We're supposed to watch it. Mm. This is what we talk about in the podcast, right. By the way.
But then there's Josh. We should say hello to Josh.
Hello, Josh.
Hey, guys.
Josh, it's Batty. Is that
Batty?
Batty. Are you originally from Boston?
Yeah, born and raised. Grew up in Plainville, Mass.
Plainville, Mass.
Which is tiny little town right down by Foxborough, Wrentham, that area. Moved down to D.C. to go to college.
GW. And International Affairs.
Yeah.
So International Affairs. Yeah. What was your plan?
I was always interested.
What were you thinking, man?
So still, you know, follow politics and all that. I said, let me go down to D.C. and you go to the belly of the beast for it. Going through it, I enjoyed it, but I realized this isn't for me. Mm. This is not what I want to do. through the course of going to school there, like a lot of people who work in this business, got involved with my college's programming board, started putting on concerts. And I said, it's a hell of a lot better than that, you know, and doing some shows at our arena there. And we partnered up, had Seth Hurwitz from the 930 Club. He was putting some shows in under the IMP banner, and he was really generous with his time, you know, when I was coming up and, you know, had lunches with him and picked his brain on this. And then he's like, go and do it. And I said, you know, should I change to a business major? Should I go do this? He's like, just get your degree and then go do it. Just keep doing it.
Did you work at the 930 Club?
I didn't. No. Yeah. Just on campus, and you know, I was kind of tooling around, working with, you know, friends' bands and some level of manager, you know, helping book them and putting on shows on campus. You know, my parents were really supportive. I think it took a little time for them to wrap their heads around it. You know, my dad's a civil engineer, immigrant from Pakistan, who, like, when you tell him, hey, I want to go
book bands,
you know, okay.
Yeah. What does that even mean?
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And especially, you know, my first job out of college was with tiny management company in Somerville, and, you know, was making nothing in bartending to pay the bills and really enjoyed it. Then about a year and a half into it, you know, I said, all right, well, now I need to find, you know, like a job in the industry, and looked all around. I said, you know, I'll probably move to New York or LA or Nashville. I guess Nashville wasn't happening quite as much then.
This is what year is this?
So this is 2004.
Okay.
And I actually took a job back down in DC and the local Clear Channel office here, now Live Nation.
Right.
I had interviewed for a job there, and they said, you know, this isn't the right role for you, but, you know, there are some things that we could find, but nothing's open right now. Kept looking around, took this job in DC, got rid of my apartment, had a U-Haul out front. At the going away party, a friend of mine who worked in that office is like, Andy left his job, and that's the job that they were talking about you for. And I said, I'll take it. And I worked there at Clear Channel right up until 2006. Then went out on my own, started a company, partnered with this guy, Sean Radley, who had done what I was doing before, booking bands, mainly for colleges and sponsored tours and that kind of thing. That's what I was doing at Clear Channel. And he had done the job before I did. He started managing Howie Day right as that thing was happening. You know, I could have gone a couple different places. And he said, why don't you just come over here? I got a desk, partner up, and I'll get you going. And so I did that for the better part of four and a half years. And that's when a friend of your podcast, Dalton Sim, called me.
Dalton, good guy.
Great guy. He called me and he said, hey, the Bowery guys are opening up
a Boston office.
Yeah. Is that something you'd be interested in talking to them about? I said, absolutely. And it was one of those things where I was doing a lot of talent buying for other people, colleges, private events, that kind of thing. And I realized it was more about getting the deal done, booking the show, less about what's coming up, the stuff that I'm really passionate about. Musically, what drives you? What got me involved with it in the first place? And, you know, I've been with Bowery now 7 years, and it's been an amazing run. And, you know, the way that they kind of started their business, you know, building bands up from the earliest stages is something that's really, you know, interesting, satisfying, and exciting.
Is that something that you in college, something that clicked with you, something that you back then envision yourself doing, is bringing up bands?
Yeah, I mean, there was always that level of nurturing, you know, when I was working with friends' bands and that kind of thing. It was like, all right, how do we take this thing that's a hobby? How do you take that and have it connect with people? And what are the different stages that you can take to get there? As a concert promoter, it's a little different. You know, it's not the same because we're not in the day-to-day conversation with any individual artist.
Right.
But it is, how do we present the show? How do we take you from Great Scott to the Sinclair to Royale, you know, and then on and growing? And
yeah, because you're a part of that for multiple bands. Like your buddy that was with Howie Day.
Yep.
You're all in.
Right.
But for you to have your tentacles in all these different up-and-coming bands is
right.
It's kind
exciting.
Of exciting.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no shortage of bands. And I think, you know, the shift in the industry where it's less about the recorded product is not the primary driver of income for a lot of these bands. They're making their money on the road. So
right.
it's becoming an increasingly important step for a band to develop.
Who comes to mind that may surprise you, or the ones that you wouldn't think are going to blow up? Or are there ones that you think, you know, this is it? But is there any surprises, I guess? Or?
All the time. You know, there are shows that you know, when you're looking at the calendar, you kind of have circled and you're saying, you know, I'm going to go to that show. I'm excited to go see that show. Then there's other ones that you kind of walk into and maybe it's an opener. Maybe it's the headliner that you kind of heard about, haven't seen. In the Sinclair, we're doing 270 shows a year. So, you know, you multiply that times two, you know, with two bands a night at least. So you're well into 500-600 bands a year just playing this room.
Well, we actually came and we saw the
Ballroom Thieves.
Ballroom Thieves. Yeah. And then Honeysuckle opened up for them.
Yep.
And they were fantastic. I mean, they were both fantastic.
Right.
But I was able to meet Honeysuckle afterwards. We bought an album. And
you just stumble upon some of these people.
You just stumble upon them, right. It's the opening act, and it's like they're these amazing musicians
and
you never would have heard of.
Right.
But it's interesting that we stumble upon them. What I mean is that people walk in and they take it for granted that there's going to be some good music here. There's a sieve, though.
Right.
And you have to be part of that funnel, right? So where do you start? I mean, you must get inundated with press packages and emails and music sent to you. Is there a way that you sort of algorithm here? Or?
It's definitely not an algorithm. I think if it was, you know, you'd have music venues all over the place and no shortage of it. At this level, it's not discovery at the level of this press pack comes in and you put this on and you go, oh, this is great. Let's book it. And then, they'll come. It's, you know.
This is how many seats are here?
This is 525.
525. So it's you have to have a following.
You have to have a following to play here. And so your filters are the agents who are repping the band's managers. And from there, you have the agents that you work with a lot that you know, hey, I'm going to take a chance on this thing because this agent generally does a good job. And agents don't try to, not every show is a sellout, obviously, but no one wants to put a show into a room that's inappropriate. If they know their act's going to draw 100, and sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes you think, hey, here's all these pieces in place. I think because we're booking, we're well into the fall with our booking season now. So, we're confirming stuff in December and January and that kind of thing now for this room. There's a risk involved there. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, everyone wants to put the band in the right room. Ultimately, it comes down to the music as well. Is there something there that connects? Is the performance there? There's no secret formula for any one act.
So before you got hired, so you basically really kind of cut your teeth before Bowery hired you. That's where you kind of relearn the real ins and outs of managing talent and buying talent and all that.
Right.
So when they hired you, how long was it before the Sinclair became an idea?
So I started in March of 2010, and pretty soon thereafter, and we had still have a booking agreement with Royale. So Royale, the owners there, do the nightclub thing in there, and then we bring in all the concerts. So all the live music is presented by us, but we don't own operate the venue. We just bring in all the shows. Mm-hmm. So we were there, and they said, go find a place. Let's go find a room. And it wasn't, we need a 500 cap room in Harvard Square. It's not, we need a 1500 cap room. It's the space kind of drives it. When you walk into a space, is it workable? What's the need in the market? I mean, Boston, I think, has a shortage of rooms, not an extreme shortage, but there's very few capacity levels, if you call it, the under 300, I put this in the 300 to 700, 700 to 1500, and then larger. Each one of those size venues could use another one in town.
And this size venue? Or each one of them?
Each size, right. And I think is it a good room? Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. When you walk into the space, is it free of columns? Is there room for a balcony? Mezzanine, because that really enhances the overall experience. So I walked in here, and Jim, one of the partners of Bowery, every time I've looked at anything else, he judges it against my reaction coming to see this place. When I walked in, and it was...
Yeah, what was that like?
I just walked in. It's such an unassuming entrance. I hadn't even seen any pictures of a listing, but you kind of like walk up the stairs, you're like, this kind of a funky little door.
Where is it even going? Space.
Yeah, exactly. And then you first walk
from
in
the outside, right?
The portion where the restaurant is, a lot of them are covered up, but there's columns every 12 feet, and you're like, that doesn't work. And then you walk back into here, and all of a sudden this opens up into this big open space that has no columns and everything else. I just walked out, called Jim right away. I'm like,
this is it.
Come on up.
Let's
get going.
In the middle of Harvard Square. I mean, there's a theater a couple doors down that's actually closed now.
Yep.
And there's, of course, this Passim right around the corner.
Yep.
This is prime real estate in Harvard Square.
In the,
it's crazy.
Our landlord here.
Something this big and open
in
the middle of such a busy place.
Our landlord here, has owned for a few generations in Harvard Square, and he's the president of the business association in the neighborhood, cares about the square, talks about Harvard Square like it's another child of his, and he's thoughtful about what goes in, what's the right mix. And in owning real estate, he's got other restaurants, other shops, other things that are all paying a rent to be here, and they need foot traffic. And he understands. He immediately knew the difference between music venue and nightclub, because I think a lot of people, we had a challenging licensing process to get the license, and it's, explain the difference between nightclub and music venue. Here you're coming, you're paying $15, $20, $30 for a ticket to come see a performance. That's what it is. It's not just for the hang. I mean, that's a big part of it. It's the experience.
It's not a DJ. right. 5 nights a week, right?
Playing other people's music and you're just dancing around. So it's very much doing that education. He knew it, and he knows that, you know, 500 people walking in here 250 nights a year, we do have the restaurant up front, but that doesn't fit everyone who's coming to the venue, and not everyone is going to come here every time to eat in our restaurant. So they're going out to the other restaurants in the square. They're going to the CVS and buying stuff. You know, it just every little thing, he understands this is what we need. And right as we were opening is when the movie theater closed. You know, the theater was a 5-screen cinema, and places like Border Cafe there. I mean, that place, you know, filling up on Mexican food before going to see a Star Wars movie. It's like that keeps the wheel turning. That thing's been closed now for
a long time.
5 years.
Yeah. I remember, I think I just read an article that I think the city has told whoever owns it, is the same guy who owns the theater?
No.
Different guy?
He would have. No way he would have sat on that.
It doesn't sound like he would let it sit there like that.
Absolutely.
And there was, I think they gave him an ultimatum. It's like, you guys got to start doing something with this.
Yeah.
Because it's probably gorgeous space in there. I mean, I saw River's Edge back there. You know the movie River's Edge?
Mm-hmm.
Great movie. Years ago. And I think they used to have show Rocky Horror there.
They did the Rocky Horror show every at midnight.
Yeah.
And before, it was a 5-screen multiplex. It was a single stage theater. Bowie played there, Iggy Pop played there, Bob Dylan played there, Joan Baez. That is,
I had no idea.
When
do you know what it was called?
It had a couple different names. I think it was, you know, the University Theater.
Wow, and that's the cool show that one full stage.
When you know, John Landau, who manages Bruce Springsteen, who is a rock critic for Rolling Stone, that's the show that he was writing about Springsteen, and he said, you know, I saw the feature of Rock and Roll, and it's Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, really?
It was at that theater down the road.
Way.
So it's got such an amazing history.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back to, you know, how you were saying how the owner of all these properties is like very careful and caring about all these different places and the restaurants and the venues here. So you and your group seem to take the same kind of care when you opened this place up with the way that it was designed. You had a special sound company come in.
Ascentec.
Yeah, Ascentec, and then and Studio Tech.
Studio Tech did the design.
And I think I even heard a quote from you. It's like, you know, we want to make sure that our neighbors are happy with us being here. So that you made sure that, I think did you blare music here to make sure that you weren't blaring everybody out of existence around here?
Yeah.
So you really took care to kind of take care of the community.
Absolutely.
Well, in the kitchen itself, like when you can eat there and you got some music on 11 here.
It's funny because, you know, our landlord, his office is right upstairs. So there's, and that's why we did all the sound attenuation work is, he's like, I can't have you in here. And, you know, all of a sudden, all my office tenants are all getting out of here and canceling their leases. So we built this thing with basically an acoustic envelope around it that holds it all in. And so as we did the lease, it was, we'll bring in a sound system, crank it up to 110, 120 decibels, which is louder than any show. In Ascentec, you know, these guys are brilliant at what they do, and they made all the recommendations of how to do the build up, but then they put mics all around the office, and
it's elaborate.
Stressful. It was a stress, you know, because you put it in, and you're like, all right, crank it up, let's go. We got to pick 3 songs, and then the landlord got to pick 3 songs.
What did you play? You remember the play?
We put on, like, you know,
Anya?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we knew we couldn't pull, you know, be that there, you know, but we had Justice was on there, and that was like our loudest, you know, song was a Justice song. But the landlord, you know, he asked his kid. And, like, he had this guy, Rusko, who was, like, a dubstep DJ. He was just the, you know, the harshest of harsh. Like, you know, we see that, and I was like, how the hell did this guy get this on? He's like, I asked my kid. And you're like, oh. So we do that. We run all around. I mean, everyone wanted it to work. You know, you're already too far into it. But we had to make sure, and it worked.
And
there were a few little places that they're like, do this, do that. You know, again, I'm trying to be a good neighbor. We don't do sound checks before 5 p.m. if we don't have to. Every neighborhood has an impact in, but this is such a busy neighborhood, we had to get it right. Mm. And we have to, you know, continue to get it right.
The fact that you can bring people together and actually listen to music together is these days almost kind of a novel concept. I mean, 20 years ago, it was more common, certainly 30 years ago. What type of energy comes into booking these bands when you think about that? When you think about people sharing that music together live and experiencing that together?
That's, I think, what makes live performance, you know, in some form or another, live musical performance is one of the oldest things out there. It's what brings people together. It's, you know, it's about being in the experience. I think that's kind of the magic of what this is. And I think did a show in college where, and I was like first guy in the building, place is empty. And, you know, 12 hours later, all the stages and the sound, the lights, the people are in, and there's this energy that was that kind of moment for me where I was like, this is what I want to do. And everyone who's coming to the show, they don't know, they don't care, nor should they. of all the work that necessarily goes in to make that happen. They're just there, and, you know, for 2-3 hours, you know, they can turn off of whatever else is going on, you know, in the world, in their lives or whatever else. I think there's, you know, something you can't replace being in a room, soaking up the energy of the performance.
I was talking to someone at work. Have you ever heard of the Sinclair? Of course, I've been in Sinclair like, you know, 3-4 times. And it takes a while, I think, for people to really get it, that it's a go-to place.
Right.
And that must take a few years. But in perpetuity, you know, you see that people associate it with that live feel of being together.
Right. And we're very careful in how we, you know, our philosophy, and it's not of any policy that's written down or anything. It's just how we operate things is your security staff, your door staff. They're there to, you know, verify IDs, make sure you're over 21 if you're going to be drinking, provide a level of safety and security when you come in. But they're also your first line of hospitality. And it's so true that they set the tone. And that has to continue throughout the experience. So the guy or the woman at the front door is immediately setting the tone. When you walk in here, mm-hmm. you're here for 2 or 3 hours. You should be able to not think about anything else going on in the world. Have a great time. And so that person at the front door, if they come off like a meathead, like we've all been to those bars where you walk in.
You don't want to feel like you're getting on an airplane.
Right, exactly. And they're like, ID. And then they get right. back to you and they're gruff.
I've had great conversations with your guy out front.
Yeah.
He's got a beard. I think his name's Mike, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Mike's one of our,
Great guy. And, it's, you know, he's just doing his job and friendly about it. And you just feel like you're welcome when you come in here.
It's like a family. You guys seem to have a vibe about you. So you're right. From everybody's job.
The bartenders have to be, you know, and that's the easier job to be friendly on is being a bartender, but it's still enough places blow it, you know, and you
plenty
can't
of
have
places
that.
Blow it.
Yep. And then that's got to continue, you know, from the edge of the stage back, you know, with our production staff and have people who want to be here, who want to be pros. You know, if we staff one extra person, you know, we always have a stage manager on for, you know, we have a front of house engineer, monitor engineer, an LD, lighting guy, and we always put a stage manager on as well to kind of help with the day. That's a lot of staff for a 500 cap room. And for us looking at it, it's like, all right, that stage manager costs us a few more bucks. But at the end of the day, what does that do to that artist experience when they walk in here and there's, you know, fresh brewed coffee here waiting for them when they walk in? There's someone there to greet them. You know, it's a tough neighborhood to park in. Yeah, I mean, we have spaces that we pull out front, but it's, you know, it's not the easiest thing. So if they just walk in and it's seamless and it's dialed and we spend real money on our sound and lights so bands don't walk in and feel like, all right, well, we got to sacrifice. We don't want anyone to sacrifice anything.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, Mike Gordon in here for 4 nights or Mo was in here for 4 nights. And that's, you know, same agent. So that, you know, they do it once and the band walks out and said, we had a great time.
Yeah. They're back.
That band will come back, but also, you know, that agent will say that, and you get that reputation. And coming up on the 5-year anniversary, it's like you can't sleep on that. You know, and you can never take that for granted because all it takes is one bad door guy to blow it. You know, one bad bartender to blow the night for someone, one bad sound engineer. It comes down to the people, and we have great people.
The JDRF is an international organization that funds critical research for treatment and ultimately a cure for type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is a life-threatening autoimmune disease that strikes both children and adults suddenly and changes life as they know it forever. It cannot be prevented and there is no cure, at least not yet. Reach the Beach is a 200-plus mile relay where teams of runners race across New Hampshire from the White Mountains to Hampton Beach for 2 non-stop days. The teams are running to support a child, spouse, or friend with this relentless disease. Please help the teams running for JDRF to raise money to help improve lives and make a meaningful difference in the treatment and cure for type 1 diabetes. To donate, go to www.jdrf.org/go-to/AOD or go to abovethebasement.com and click on Community Our Causes menu. I want to go back to about when we were talking about the importance of live music in everybody's life, it's something that I certainly forgot. I hadn't gone to a concert in a long, long time. And only recently have I started to really kind of make an effort to go out. And you forget how amazingly connecting watching live music with other people in the room.
Right.
And one of the, and I've said this before in the podcast, and so for anyone who's heard this before, I apologize. But it was right after the election, and I saw Sun Kil Moon here.
Yeah.
Everyone was just kind of down, and you could feel the tension. Is and he's an interesting guy, anyways.
Right.
And he came on, and he just said something along the lines of, "Okay, I know everyone. There's a lot of a lot of stress out there with the election. We're not going to talk about it. We're just going to play some music. And you could feel the tension just kind of dissipate. You could feel it in the room. It was really very potent, and a really just simple act of playing live music and a very intimate, I mean, it's a 525 seat theater, and it certainly looks big empty, but when it's full, it's very cozy, and you feel you're not far from the stage at all.
No, yeah.
Well, there's something about this stage too that is intimate. It's a great balance with intimacy along with solid, crisp sound that is big.
Yeah.
That's a rare combination. There's a place in Burlington, Vermont that I've been to many times, Higher Ground.
Yeah. Alex is
colleague of yours?
Yeah, so he we're partners with him in Maine. So he's had the Higher Ground forever. We've done our thing in the region.
This reminds me of Higher Ground.
Yeah. In the State Theater in Portland, Maine, and Port City Music Hall.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Thompson
Sports. Port City Music Hall, yeah.
So that opportunity came up. It started with the State Theater, and Alex reached out to Jim and Jomo at Bowery, and we're like, hey, there's this opportunity here for this. And
Thompson Point is in Portland.
Yes.
Right, and that's an outdoor venue that's pretty new.
This is the third season.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm going to go see Alabama Shakes there in August.
It's
and
a Guster's
great place. Playing there on August 12th, but I can't make it. But
you don't see anyone saying a bad thing about Portland. It's like, you know,
it's a great restaurant,
great this, great that. Yeah. But and it's unbelievable that they just support the arts like crazy. People come out.
So we've been singing the praises of the Sinclair, and we are huge fans of the Sinclair. I've seen several shows here, and we've talked about it in our podcast several times actually, because we've had a couple of guests who've played here. But as far as the state of live music within the Boston area. There was an article about you. You said you were seeing changes in the way people are consuming live music. And I don't know if it's a Boston thing or if it's just something that you've noticed being in the business for a while. Do you see a change in that at all?
You were saying how you didn't go to shows for a really long time. Kids are older?
My kids are like 15.
You're busy raising a family. And the other thing I've realized of late is this is, you know, I wouldn't say the first generation, but rock music itself, you know, and it's current state is new. It's not hundreds of years old, you know? It's like you go back to 50s, 60s. People are having kids. People are staying, luckily, they're staying healthier longer. And so, you know, you get to that point where your kids are growing up, and you're like, I still got a lot of...
Got at least 6-7 years left.
Right. Yeah. So
I give you 10.
Thank you.
Well, you know, whereas you go back, you know, a generation before that, or, you know, these weren't necessarily people who grew up on rock music and going to shows this way. So... We see it here, and maybe I don't know what it is about the Sinclair, Cambridge, maybe it's Boston in general, but we see an older, you know, we'll have the same show here, Port City Music Hall, which might skew a little bit older, but, you know, they play here, they might go play Music Hall of Williamsburg in New York and Union Transfer in Philadelphia, so like all venues that we have, and we tend to skew a little bit older here, and I don't know if that's with the same show, but I also think, you know, it's just... People are going out.
Now, are you a musician at all? Do you play? Or?
Not at all.
So
you don't want to see me play. You don't want to hear me sing.
Were you always interested in music?
Totally. Yeah. You know, it was one of those things where growing up in Plainville, it was, you know, you could shoot up here and go to something at the Middle East that was an all-ages show pretty easily. You could go down to Providence. I did it, you know, went down there a lot to Lupo's and the Met Cafe when that was the second iteration of Lupo's on Westminster Street there. And, you know, and I kind of ran the gamut musically too, you know, in terms of like what I was listening to. You know, I had Fish and Dave Matthews tape collections, but I had friends who were in ska bands and went to a lot of those shows. And that was, you know, I was born, you know, 1980. So, I was a little young for that first wave of grunge and hip hop when it first kind of like,
when that was
like taking off. Like, I, you know, as a 10, 11 year old, I wasn't going to see, you know,
yeah, that was like 92.
Bands. Right, exactly.
And it was internet was just in infancy. You know, you're not streaming, you're not sending music around the world. I mean, you're still sharing CDs and
we were doing tapes, yeah.
And you know, you're like, doing live bootlegs.
Yeah, yeah, the live bootleg thing where you would, you know, Maxell XL2 tape of, you know, this show.
I remember
first
buying
generation,
those,
yeah.
Those 10 packs of those Maxell tapes. I remember.
XL2, XL2S.
Yeah, the XL2S.
Those are my favorite, the XL2S, yes. Yeah. Those are good.
And no high speed dubbing, you know, you want to get the closest to first generation soundboard, that kind of thing. And, you know, that was just like a fun way to consume. And, you know, again, that, you know, community thing where you were trading stuff for free. Like, you weren't exchanging money. It was just builds this little tribe.
Can't do that anymore. Now they come after you.
It's interesting where this came from that sort of organic trading of music, the appreciation for music. as a non-musician.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about when it clicked with you that this could be a career.
Right.
Because it really clearly has been a passion since you were a kid.
It was a passion. I think I didn't think of it as a viable career. And, you know, sure, you knew there were record labels and these big companies, and Capitol Records has this big, cool building, but I didn't know everything else that went into it and what an industry it is. And it's a viable career option for a lot of people in a million different facets of the business, whether it's being a concert promoter, being a manager, an agent, a music attorney, a PR person. You know, there's so many different places to work in the industry.
And where do you see yourself next? I mean, you know, it's kind of that classic annoying question of the 5-year, 10-year plan, but do you have other thoughts about where you want to take this?
I think we couldn't be more happy with how this room turned out, from the build out to how we execute on a nightly basis to what we have on our calendar. And this is the only room that we own operate in the city. So love to do more of these, because I think there's a real...
More of these rooms.
And not, you know, at different sizes, and just get it right and have a good experience. You know, I think that's... In talking about when you're designing a room and laying it out, you know, how it looks, how it feels, what the flow's like, you know, if you're a fan of a band and you're free that night of the show, you're going to go see the show, whether it's here or any of the other venues in town or a basement or whatever, like you'll go to that show. So there's a certain level of, like, the tickets are sold because of the act, and we never lose sight of that. But, you know, so much, your margins as a promoter are pretty thin, and it's, you're making your money in that last, you know, 10-15% of the ticket buyers. And so what makes those last 10-15% of people buy a ticket? You know, whatever you can do within your power to incentivize them, and that's through having a good experience. So I know, going to shows, you know, as a fan, yeah, I really want to see that band. I don't want to go there for whatever reason.
I totally do that.
That's your profit. So if you blow it with the room, and you could probably, you know, I don't know, maybe you could model this out and figure out, all right, if you saved money on your build out, you know, and you did it, you know, you skipped a few corners. I mean, you know, when we were running behind on our build out schedule,
right,
you know, we were late and we were over budget. It's like, we're talking to the contractor. Okay, what can we do to speed up the pace, cut the budget a little bit? First thing he said was this balcony here that, mm-hmm. that we built, that this was not existing. He said, well, you could cut that, you know, and that would save you a ton of time welding in money. And it's like, no way, we're not touching that thing. Like, that's going in. Let's figure it out somewhere else. You know, what else can we do? Because, you know, you don't want to skim at the most basic good experience parts of the...
Well, Concrete Blonde was your first guest here, right?
Yeah.
And I think I read somewhere where that they couldn't have been happier with how awesome this place was, especially since it just opened it was running behind. And like, I think it said, like, you were running around, like, sweeping floors and, like, pulling down tape and just getting it ready for them.
Day by day, at that time, we were trying, you know, we were, October 30th was supposed to be our first show.
Yeah.
And luckily, when you first open a room, it's kind of hard to have your calendar full right away. So we had 20 shows between October 30th and December 12th.
They had to rebook. What a nightmare.
I think that was not
Concrete
a fun time.
Blonde, wow.
Yeah, and that was, like, that was supposed to be show 21, 22.
Yeah.
And end up being show one. We were able to move virtually every single show that was supposed to play here.
Yeah,
I think we only had to cancel one. And then since then, I think almost all of those 20 bands have been back here in some form or another.
The opposite of that effect of that 10-15%, where you're talking about, if you know a band, you want to see them anywhere.
Yep.
The opposite of that is sometimes true, too. For me, I saw David Wax Museum a couple years ago here.
Yeah.
You know, my friend John, I knew he had good taste in music, so I was like, sure. I mean, I'll see anything.
Right.
Know? It's at the Sinclair. Oh, great. Bonus. You know,
right.
And so that kind of thing, I think there's a certain demographic or whatever, or clients, like customers, I guess, like me, that, you know, you just have a trust in the venue. You know, I think that's a testament to this place.
Right.
I also love the fact that you can come up here and you can listen. And I like standing back. I don't like being up front.
Right.
I'm old and I want to keep my hearing as long as I can. But I love being able to, like, just step out and you're in a separate area right there. And it's just a very comfortable place to be.
Yeah.
The Brussels sprouts, by the way.
You like the Brussels sprouts, too.
I know that. So if you're listening to this podcast, make sure you have the Brussels sprouts.
Yes. I don't know what it is with you and your Brussels sprouts. Funnily enough. This weekend is Boston Calling.
Yeah.
And you used to book it.
Yeah.
And we actually interviewed Trevor Solomon in your kitchen.
Yep.
He took over when everyone switched gears and started doing something different.
Sorry, the Sinclair kitchen.
The Sinclair kitchen.
Because anyone who's listening to this probably thinks that we interviewed a guy named Trevor
in his kitchen. Yeah, in the Sinclair kitchen. Are you going to Boston Calling this weekend?
Absolutely.
Are you going all three days?
Probably, yeah.
I don't know if I can do all 3 days. I'm probably going to go Saturday.
It's a great lineup.
I want to see Tool.
Yeah.
I want to see Sigur Rós. I used to listen to them a lot, and I've never seen them live.
Yeah.
But, you know, Mumford and & Sons. And I also would have liked to see Chance the Rapper. That's on Friday night. Unless you go all 3 days, you're going to miss somebody awesome.
But, yeah. I think I mentioned it to Trevor. I was just looking at him. Like, there's not a day that you're like, it's just something every day I want to see.
Did you enjoy booking something as large as Boston Calling? And how is it compared to booking to something specific to the Sinclair?
I mean, booking a festival is a whole different, it's a different ballgame. Yeah. I mean, you're booking a bunch of bands that kind of all, it's about, you know, what's the overall vibe and feel of the festival. You know, you're dealing with the same people. At the end of the day, it's the same agents. There's some different economics to how a festival is structured and what an artist is trying to get out of it rather than a headlining play. But, you know, it was the first ticketed proper music festival that Boston had had. So
yeah, plus it was right in Government Center.
Government Center at the time, yeah.
Which is like
now it's going to be Alston, insane. Right?
Yeah, it's going to be right there. It's not in the Coliseum. It's all right the grounds around it.
Okay, yeah.
All the athletic fields. So I think that's...
How's the weather going to be?
I think it's all right. Right
now? I hope it's going to be good.
Yeah.
I'm very sensitive.
That's... Well, I'm, so are the crowds and the booking agents.
Yeah, they might not. They won't care.
It's
sounds like they're selling out, and they just have only a few tickets left.
Yeah, it's definitely a better spot. I mean, when you're talking about what most music festivals are, I mean, I think the City Hall Plaza, it was there, and it's kind of where it had to be in the early years for a bunch of reasons.
There.
And yeah, you can't have over. You know, no two bands can be playing at
the same
one time.
Right.
Which is good, you know, and you know you can say it's great, you know, like you're guaranteed not to miss a band, like
right.
Sigur Rós is, you know, could be playing up against Chance the Rapper. I don't know exactly how it lines up, but like, you know, so you have to make decisions, and that's how most festivals are, and that's all right. And I think it's more of an experience where you can get out and move around and kind of
go check one guy out and leave and go to somewhere else. Yeah, that's cool. As far as just how Boston is shaping up as a city for live music, I mean, a lot of concern with TT to Bears closing and Johnny D's, and there's a lot of concern about the state of music venues in Boston. Sinclair kind of came into being right before that all started kind of happening. Those started going under. And then there's certainly some other venues opening up, like the Thunder Road opened up, and you could probably list a few
Once
more
in summer.
Once in Somerville.
And now TT's reopened as Sonia, and it's a different room. You know, so I think I said this somewhere else when this comes up, you know, and there's a million articles like, oh, you know, the live music is dying and all these venues are closing. It's kind of like an easy headline to write, I guess, you know, like when they open in a closed time. And it's always like, you know, you don't like seeing venues close, but I think, you know, as a venue closes, others open up. So you have Once that opens up. You know, we opened here only 5 years ago. So you have, there's a shift, and Johnny D's is a great example. I mean, that's a family-run business, and it's a piece of real estate that is unbelievably undervalued, you know, in that neighborhood. So at some point, something's got to give.
Mm-hmm.
I do think as values in cities go up and up and up, Boston, I think especially as you see growth, it can threaten, you know, music venues is we're never the highest and best use of a piece of real estate. Music venues don't pay the highest rents in the world, and it's not, you know, we're dark today. Luckily, we're not dark here a lot, but even when we're open, take away the restaurant side of things, I mean, we're open for a few hours a day and we're dark a lot. Think of any other commercial retail business, like you're open all the time.
Yeah.
You know, so you only have a finite amount of time to make that money. And when you do dollars and cents, it's not the best use. So, but it takes, you know, people like our landlord here and other developers to realize what's the actual value of having an art space, whether it's our use as a music venue, is it, you know, theater, is it classical music? Hey, you know, whatever it is, I think it's important that, you know, it becomes the fabric of a community.
And it's become a more of a destination again. I mean, I used to, when I grew up, we would come to Harvard Square all the time. We'd go to the Coop, and it was just something that we did. And then eventually, I just like, I had no reason to come here.
Right.
Because now you do again.
Now I do again.
Yeah.
I do. I've been here for the last year. I've been here God knows how many times. I've been in Harvard Square because, you know, certainly because of the podcast, but because of the music that we've been going to see. It's fantastic.
And you come here and can only eat the Brussels sprouts so much. So sometimes you're going to want to, you know, walk in the road and try another place in the hood. And we know that, you know, the other restaurants in the neighborhood, they know when we were first getting going, like they would keep an eye on our calendar. If they see a show is sold out, they know that they'll get a bump from it. So it's I think it's important to protect venues, and you don't want to see too many venues closing. But I do think it's cyclical, and I think today's neighborhood that's run down and not much is going on is tomorrow's next up and coming neighborhood. I mean, you see it everywhere.
Yeah.
And before we close up, what is Sinclair? Where does that come from again? The actual word?
We were, you know, going through the history of the neighborhood, and nothing was connecting, and Jim one of the partners, he said the Sinclair. It's the middle name of some other guy in the business. And it just kind of like took the piss out. It stuck. And we said, let's do it. And yeah, no real.
You know? Joe, do you know? What are you raising your hand for? Oh, you're just stretching.
Hello? Joe has a question. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm about to take a picture of Josh in front of the sign, so I thought maybe you want to ask about this a little bit.
That's a nice segue.
Yeah. The sign right there?
Yeah, that's the original.
That's the original sign?
That's the original sign. So when we opened, being in Harvard Square, you're also in a historic district.
Yeah.
And the, you know, so we had to go through the rigmarole to get that Blade sign out there and the marquee. So that was the original temporary sign. That's where the marquee is, that fit right into that space.
And interesting.
It's like that for about a year, I want to say, with just that, with no Blade signs.
I vaguely
signs.
Remember that, yeah.
I don't remember that at all. One last question.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the biggest thing you're looking forward to this year for the Sinclair?
I love the multi-night runs that we do here. You know, when you have a band that sets up shop, whether it's two nights, three nights, four nights, and some of them are kind of staples. Rebirth Brass Band has been doing four shows over two nights twice a year for the last couple of years.
Oh, really?
And then you have we have a bunch of those coming up, some of them not announced yet, that are always just super exciting. It's always, I don't know, there's a specialness to
that. Yeah, that's a word.
Yeah.
Funnily, there is.
Funnily, it is a word.
I never saw Mike Gordon when he's here, but God, that would be great.
Yeah.
He's a bass player for Phish. I have a special request.
Yeah.
I was at Jazz Fest in New Orleans a couple weeks ago. I always see the meters. How can we get them here?
That one cuts deep. That was supposed to be the first show.
Really? The Funky Meters.
It was the Meter Men. So
they would
be
so good in this room.
So it was the Meters with Paige from Phish. So they did a tour in 2012. All those guys got together. They did that because they do a whole bunch of iterations. You know, you have the Funky Meters, the Meters, the original Meters, and this is like
George Porter's the anchor to that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so Art Neville, you know, he doesn't tour, and you know,
Art Neville play with them.
He's got you. Gotcha. Yeah. So that's the original. Yeah, yeah. But Art doesn't tour. He's a little older, and so they had Paige fill in, and that was supposed to be the first show here. We moved it to Royale, so it still played. It happened. It was an awesome show.
Oh, really?
Granted, it would have been really badass here, but
Somehow,
we'll take them back here if they do that.
I just
again.
Was at Tipitina's like a couple weeks ago and saw them there.
They're just so good.
Yeah,
they're
great.
Just so good.
Well, Josh, thanks, man, for
your
time.
Thanks for having me.
Really,
it's a lot of fun. Absolutely.
It was cool to be on the Sinclair stage with Josh. The Sinclair team has really put together a great venue. Make sure you check their schedule at sinclaircambridge.com and go to our newly updated website at abovethebasement.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, listen and subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. And remember, Boston music, like its history, is unique.